Daniel J. Duke is the great-great-grandson of Jesse James. He grew up surrounded by stories of lost outlaw treasures for more than two decades. He's researched the mysteries involving his family, Freemasonry, and the Knights Templar, and he lives in the great Republic of Texas. Daniel J. Duke, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine, and how are you?
Terrific. Thank you. Let me just ask you right out of the chute. How do we know, how do you know you're the great-great-grandson of Jesse James?
Well, right off the bat, when we first, my family, it's been a legend in our family from generation to generation, passed down ever all the way from Jesse through, who went under the name of James Lafayette Courtney. And the stories, you know, it's an oral tradition in the family. And my mother decided she wanted to know who was right, the traditional history or our family story. So she started her search to prove, you know, whether we were right or wrong.
And is there any DNA evidence or photographs or historical documents?
We had family photographs that had been passed down, and my mother started all that. She started checking out, you know, getting all the family photographs we could of, you know, my great-great-grandfather, his family members, his brother, his mother, anybody she could get the photos of. And those were all passed down through the family. And she took those to, instead of going to just anybody, she went to the biggest experts she could find, the Texas Department of Public Safety, who's our version of state police. They're the Texas State Police. She went to their forensic lab, and they verified that our photos matched Jesse and his family members, the traditionally accepted photos of them. And then she went to the Austin Police Department Forensic Photographic Lab, and they verified that our photos matched the historically accepted versions. And the third group she went to was a company called Visionics. They were world leaders in facial recognition technology, and they verified the same thing. So we had three separate groups that weren't paid. It was just, you know, their professional opinion, and that's all three of them verified that our family photographs matched the traditionally accepted photographs. So that was the big break, and from there we went into census records, the diaries that Jesse had passed down through the family, and in the diary he mentions known gang members. So there was a lot of information that just kept stacking up.
That's good enough for me.
Sure.
Now, let me ask, growing up, having an ancestor who was a notorious outlaw, a train robber, what did you hear about him as a person, as a man? Was he volatile? Was he violent? Was he kind? Was he a Robin Hood, as some have said?
From family stories, everyone has said he lived at low profile. He was very mysterious, but he was also a nice man. He wasn't, you know, he didn't go out of his way to, you know, he wasn't skipping around, you know, happy, but he was just a nice, you know, normal, quiet man, and he lived very low key. Even in the history books, you know, stories about Jesse before 1882, he wasn't one to go to saloons and live it up. But he was hard worker. But he didn't do a lot of hard labor. He had other people doing that for him because he had the money to pay them, which doesn't sound like a normal farmer back in those days. During the Great Depression, when he was older, a lot of people in that area said that he and a couple of his friends who were former Quantrell's guerrillas, they always wore nice clothes and drove a car around when everybody else was hurting, but they kept the banks afloat, which kept business going in the small town that they were in.
But I mean, the Jesse James, the train robber, the, you know, the outlaw, before we get into whether, you know, he faked his death and lived a long life, the idea that, you know, there are reports that, you know, he was particular about who he robbed. If he saw that they were a working person, he might leave them alone. Is any of that true?
I've heard that, and I believe it. There's a lot of accounts of that. Even from the people who were robbed, they would, you know, they would go through the train or a stage, whatever they were robbing, and they would check their hands, and if they looked like they were a hard worker, they wouldn't take their money. And they didn't get rough with people or push people around. They you know, they were there to rob. If somebody tried to do anything, you know, they would have gotten rough. They probably would have shot them. But other than that, they tried to keep it as professional and quick as possible without hurting anybody.
And what set him on this path? Not only him, but his brother, Frank. Why did they turn to a life of crime?
Well, during the Civil War, the Civil War is said to have started a decade earlier in Missouri, in the 1850s. They said that, well, there were pro-Union and pro-Confederate before the Confederacy came into being. It was pro-slavery and anti-slavery. Groups from Kansas would form and raid into Missouri, robbing, stealing, pillaging, and then, you know, the Missouri people on the Missouri side of the border would band together and, you know, go pay them back. Well, the fighting got more and more brutal and escalated, and during the Civil War, Jesse was too young to fight in the normal Confederate Army. Frank had already joined. Jesse was at home. He was plowing in his field, and a group of Union guerrillas, the Jayhawkers from Kansas, rode onto the farm, strapped Jesse to a plow. He was only 14 at the time. Strapped him to a plow, brutally beat him, rode onto the house. Jesse's mother was pregnant. They pushed her around. Some accounts say she was whipped and tied to a tree, and they hung his stepfather, Dr. Reuben Samuel, from a tree. It didn't kill him, but it gave him permanent brain damage. So Jesse wanted revenge. I guess he healed up after the beating, went and found, he couldn't join the normal Confederacy because of his age, and he found a group, Quantrill's guerrillas, who would let him fight. And that's, you know, he was very good at what he did. All the guerrillas were extremely good marksmen. They were great horsemen. They had such a bad reputation, most people they were afraid of just the name. But the fighting was brutal throughout the Civil War, mostly Redlegs and Quantrill's guerrillas back and forth. Sometimes Union troops would be involved. And after the war had ended, when everybody else in the Confederate Army was granted amnesty, they didn't grant amnesty to the guerrillas. So it was, if they turned themselves in like Jesse had tried to do, Jesse tried to turn himself in, he got a bullet through the lung for his efforts, and somehow lived. And they knew that if they surrendered or got caught, they would be executed. And that, you know, it kind of forces you. You have to make a choice, leave the country or live up to your name as an outlaw. And I guess, you know, obviously they chose to live up to their outlaw brand.
And were they targeting trains that were carrying gold?
From what I understand, they targeted a lot of the gold shipments. That they had intel, somehow they had intel, and they usually knew what trains or stages were carrying gold. Sometimes, you know, they would also go through and rob some of the passengers, but that wouldn't have amounted to much sometimes, and they had to have good intel, and I don't know how they got the intel, but it was a pretty well-organized group.
And how did they manage to, because they were operating for, about 10 years, how did they manage to avoid or evade the authorities for so long?
They lived a low-profile life. They had a close-knit, in their part of Missouri, they were all close-knit. You know, the war was over, but people still, you know, had their sides. So their family, relatives, friends, even one of the, you know, some of the local law in the area, they all kept their mouths shut, and some out of fear, probably, and others out of loyalty to family. And a lot of the people in that area, including most of the guerrillas, were related to each other one way or another through blood or marriage. So there was a lot of loyalty. They fought together. They were related, and it's, you know, that. And it was a small group of people, close-knit, and they were well-trusted that they surrounded themselves with. And nobody had a good identification, the Pinkertons and everybody else, nobody had a good ID of Jesse other than his family and friends. So, you know, it was kind of hard for them to catch someone who they didn't even know what he looked like.
Would you say the Pinkertons, this was the security company, you know, that they they would provide a Pinkerton man on the stagecoaches and so forth to provide security.
Exactly.
They later become sort of like the Brinks of their day, or they were the Brinks of their day.
In fact, the Pinkerton agency exists today. So.
Okay. Now, what was the motive? It wasn't because, as you say, he kept a low profile, he wasn't spending the money. What was the intent? Why were they accumulating this wealth?
I used to wonder, too. A lot of people, you know, traditional history says they all died broke. They robbed so much. They didn't die broke. I know Jesse didn't. And a lot of the others were, they did fairly well. They didn't go spend it and blow it like a lot of people, you know, a lot of outlaws are said to have done. They had a reason for hiding it, and I believe that's what tied in to the Freemasons. But later on, after Jesse had, a lot of people don't realize Jesse had tried to fake his death in 1879, and it didn't work. He was wanting out earlier. He came to Texas in 1871 and got married to Thomas Hudson Barron's daughter. Barron was a Texas Ranger, a former Texas Ranger, and they had known each other somehow. That's still a mystery, but they had a prearranged meeting in July of 1871, just outside of Fort Worth. They met, went to Stephenville, parted, and then 3 weeks later, Jesse showed up at Barron's ranch or farm, and he bought 160 acres paid for in gold. He had his saddlebags were full of gold coins. He paid for his ranch and built a home, all paid for in gold coins. And that, but back in those days, that was very rare for somebody to have that much gold on them.
Right. But is there, I believe you've offered up the theory, and others have as well, that they, the James gang and the Younger gang, they were essentially raising money to launch a second civil war. Is that true?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I'm just asking, is there any truth to that?
Oh, well, the KGC were called the Knights of the Golden Circle. They had spies. They were like a secretive Confederate organization during the war, and their purpose was to basically slow or halt, if they could, any Union troop movements. When somebody's at war, both sides will usually have groups like that kind of moving around, burning bridges, trying to do anything to halt or at least slow their enemy's movements. The KGC did that. They were good at it. During the war, that was their basic objective. After the war, it's claimed that the Knights of the Golden Circle, their main objective was to gain enough wealth to fight a second civil war. They wanted all the wealth they could get, any way they could get it, to fund a second civil war. And that was their alleged goal.
And is there any evidence to suggest that Jesse James threw his lot in with the KGC, the Knights of the Golden Circle, and was willing perhaps to give them some of his gold to that end?
I have never seen any proof that they were a part of that. It wouldn't shock me if they were during the war, but after the war, I highly doubt it. I think a lot of things had changed for him, and after the war, I don't think he was a part of that, if that was going on. It wouldn't shock me if he was, had something to do with it while he was during the war, but afterwards, I don't believe he had anything to do with it.
All right, so we've got about 4 minutes here before the bottom of the hour, and we'll break at that point. But up until then, let's just spend a few minutes. We'll get into it. We'll follow it up after the break. Let's talk a little bit about Jesse's last days, 1882, and supposedly, according to the official narrative, he is killed by a gentleman by the name of Robert Ford, I guess, who had somehow infiltrated the James Younger gang. So just kind of walk us through that.
Okay, that was a very good description of the traditional history. Jesse was said to have been shot by Robert Ford. Robert and his brother Charlie were supposedly working undercover for the governor of Missouri, and their job was basically to track his movements, and they had, you know, because they wanted to put a stop to Jesse. The robbing had gotten so bad, you know, trains and stages, that a lot of trains were rerouting to go around Missouri instead of going through it or that entire area. So, you know, it was hurting the economy of the state, and the state wanted an end to it. So the traditional history says that, you know, Bob and Charlie Ford one night in at the, a home in St. Joseph, Missouri, north of where he grew up on his farm, Jesse was supposedly took his guns off, stepped up on a chair to dust a painting or straighten it, and Bob and Charlie Ford drew their guns and shot him in the back of the head. So that was a traditional story. I don't believe that that's what happened. We have proof that basically blows holes in that story.
No pun intended.
No.
But, you know, people can go online and they can see the what they used to call the box shot in the days, you know, the tabloid newspapers, where you would have a picture of the deceased laid out in the coffin. And there's a picture of Jesse James, who, you know, arguably it kind of looks like him. So how do we know that Jesse James didn't die at the hands of Robert Ford in 1882?
I believe Jesse, it was Jesse's cousin, Wood Height, who bore a strong resemblance to Jesse. Wood Height had been killed earlier in a fight with Dick Liddell, and Bob and Charlie Ford's sister had her name was Martha. She had a farm. Dick Liddell was, and Wood Height got in a gunfight, and Wood Height was killed. There was a farmhand, I believe his name was Jim Gibson, but he died too. It said that Wood Height killed the farmhand, or that was one theory, but Wood Height killed the farmhand. There was a fight. People were mad. Tempers were, you know, people lost their tempers, got in a gunfight, and Dick Liddell shot Wood Height. Nobody knew where Wood Height's grave was. To this day, they can't point it out. But they Wood Height was the one who was killed and passed off as his cousin Jesse. He was Jesse's first cousin and bore a very strong resemblance to Jesse.
So they just kept him on ice, and then at some point, what, Jesse just said, hey, we can seize upon this opportunity to fake my death. Is that how it played out?
I believe so.
And what about Rob Ford? I mean, he was hired by the governor of Missouri. Was he paid off? We'll get to that after the break. We'll address those questions when our conversation with Daniel J. Duke, the author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, continues. Here's Kim Mitchell taking us into the break with a Canadian summer standard, Patio Lanterns, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada, affiliate in-depth radio News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, the website strangeplanet.ca. Daniel J. Duke, the great-great-grandson of Jesse James, is here. The book is Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. Before the break, Daniel, we were talking about the supposed assassin or killer of your great-great-granddad, Robert Ford, who infiltrated the James Younger gang at the behest of the governor of Missouri, who wanted Jesse James out of the way because they were robbing so many trains, they were diverting all the train traffic out of Missouri, which would have cost the state dearly, no doubt. And you said that it was likely that it wasn't Jesse James that was shot, it was his first cousin. And Jesse James seized upon that opportunity because he looked like his cousin. They had a striking resemblance. But that leaves the answer, or the question rather, as to why Robert Ford would have gone along with that ruse if he had been paid by the governor, if he was on orders of the governor to kill Jesse James.
There's a lot of questions on that. he could have been in with Jesse, maybe playing both sides, or maybe he thought Wood Height was Jesse. Wood Height was known to go around. You know, he would rob. He was an outlaw as well. He robbed trains, and you know, he rode with Jesse. He also went on his own. And in a lot of cases, there were a lot of robberies that had been attributed to the James gang, but they would be over 100 miles apart, and it was in such a close time frame, they couldn't have possibly ridden from one bank or train to the next location. I think in a lot of cases that was Wood Height leading, robbing one and Jesse and the others robbing another. In a way, it was a lot like during the Civil War when they were guerrillas. They would split and attack two different areas sometimes or more and then come back together at a meeting point somewhere, which makes perfect sense. It sounds like a military operation, and it kept people confused. Another good point with Wood Height doing that was, also robbing. It made it harder for if he claimed to be Jesse or if people just assumed that, there was slight differences in their appearance, in their height, and that would also cause more confusion on what Jesse really looked like. So, in some cases they said he was about 5'9 or 5'10. In other cases, they would say he was very tall. He was a tall, fine-built man. And my great-great-grandfather, Jesse, was around 6'3 to 6'4. So he was a tall man, especially in those days. That was considered fairly tall.
Now, so at this point, after the death of his cousin, and so the theory goes, Jesse James basically goes underground and moves to Texas, where he lives out his name under an alias, James L. Courtney. How is it you're able, because, there are a number of versions of this story where Jesse James did fake his death. Some have him living in Oklahoma. In your version, he's in Texas under the name of L. James Courtney, or James L. Courtney. Exactly. How did you track him there? How do you know that James L. Courtney was, in fact, Jesse James?
Well, when he came to Texas, first of all, a lot of people had said in the past, well, why would he leave his wife and children? Z. Mims was said to have been his wife, and he had two children with her. Well, it wasn't Jesse's children. That was Wood Height's children. Wood Height was killed. They weren't Jesse's children, but they were taken care of throughout their life, mostly because, that goes off on another story completely. But like at the inquest, the coroner's inquest after the alleged assassination, when Zerelda got there to identify the body, her first words were, "Gentlemen, you've made a mistake. That is not my son." She was someone walked her out of the room, and she came back in a few minutes later bawling and claiming that was her son. So why would she say it wasn't her son and then turn around and claim it was? I think someone let her know, hey, go along with this. And then at the inquest, for example, his alleged wife, Z. Mims, she told the court exactly how many jewels she had, all her jewelry down to fine detail, but she didn't know Jesse's age, or he was said to have been missing the tip of one of his fingers. She didn't know which finger that would have been. So if they had been married for so long, why didn't she know his age or which finger was missing? It seems like most people would know that about their spouse.
Right. Especially if they're playing the newlywed game.
Exactly. And also at the funeral, Jesse's aunt asked Zerelda, she told Zerelda, she said, "That's not the Jesse I knew." And Zerelda said, "That's my rabbit's foot."
Ah.
So, there's little things like that. There's a lot more where that came from.
But very cryptic, no doubt. Enough to fill another book. So back to James L. Courtney, who lives out his life in Texas. How do we trace him there?
Well, he had his diary. He had been in Texas before, during and after the Civil War. We had his diary from 1871 to 1876, which details his movements down. But in his diary, he lists known gang members like Bill Wilkerson and Bud Singleton and others, and he signed one of the pages J. James. Also, we've had hit the writing in his diary. A handwriting expert examined the writing in the diary with a historically accepted letter from Jesse, and the writing was, she said, the writing matched.
So you've got two samples, one before 1882 and one after.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, and we've got letters that he had written to family members afterwards also. So
What about photographs of James L. Courtney? Are there any of those, and do they look like Jesse James?
Yeah, well, as I'd mentioned earlier, the ones we had examined by the forensic experts, the Texas Department of Public Safety, Austin Police Department, and Visionics, there were also photographs after. He loved having his photograph taken, and he had his photograph taken up into his 80s when he was an old man, and there's all the photos match. We didn't have every photo examined. We just had the most important ones examined. But they're all Jesse, and they all match. I mean, it's a clear, like, the chronology of his life in photographs.
And was it well known in this town where James L. Courtney lived that he was, in fact, Jesse James, but no one wanted to out him?
Exactly, yeah. Well, a lot of the men who lived around him were former Quantrell's guerrillas, and that's well known today. I mean, you can talk to any of the old-timers in that area, and they'll tell you there's a couple of Freemasons I know who live in the area, and they know all about the story. And the lodge that he was a member of is still in existence today. So there were Quantrell's guerrillas and a lot of his family, and like I'd mentioned before, a lot of the guerrillas were related through marriage or blood, and they were very loyal to each other.
And so what year did James L. Courtney die?
1943, and he was 97 years old.
Oh, my gosh. So he lived nearly 60 years after his supposed death in 1882 at the hands of Robert Ford.
Yes. He lived to be an old man. I mean, he was very – there were a lot of cases in his diary and other letters where he would mention getting chills in the night. He got chills a lot, and I think it was from old wounds. When he died, it was in they took him to the Bowie Clinic in Marlin, Texas. And what bothered me and my mother, we found out where he died. We wanted to see if they still had the records. They had destroyed the records a couple of years before we got there. If we'd have been a few years earlier, we would have had his death records and the description, any scars and all that on his body.
Right, right. Okay, so now we have to, we come to the fascinating chapter of the maps. These encoded maps that seem to be, you know, containing some Masonic symbols and so forth. How were these maps discovered? Presumably after his death?
Well, yes, after he had drawn, there were little symbols and clues, and he'd also written code in his diary. So, you know, that piqued our interest, of course. You know, when you're reading through the diary and all of a sudden there's a lot of code, and then it skips, and a few pages later, a few days later, there was more code. We started working on that. There were little symbols that he had written in his diary up in the margins, and also the known gang members. The map, though, the one that passed down to us through the family, he had drawn a treasure map that was located somewhere around Blevins, Texas, I believe. And after he died, well, when he died, during his funeral, half his children were digging up the yard instead of going. And they didn't go to the funeral. They wanted to look for the gold.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of bad, really sad in a way. But after that, one of his sons, Byron, drew out the map. He made a copy of the original map, and we have the copy that Byron made. I don't know what he did with the original map, but we have the copy he made, and that's what passed down to us.
Now, when you say there was codes in his diary and presumably codes on the map, describe them. What kind of codes?
He would usually, you know, they were real simple. He would usually, it would be a mixture of letters and numbers. And it took a while, but I think we figured it out on the codes. It was, he would, you know, A, the letter A would be number 1, the letter Z would be number 26. But then he would flip it around sometimes and, you know, and make it backwards. So Z was 1 and A was 26. Or he'd go half, he would play around with the numbers, but if you worked at it long enough, you could figure out. It helped a lot that in the middle of some of the numbers, there would be letters that went along with, you know, the word it was supposed to spell out. So it was fairly easy. It just took a little work. But the problem with that, it was easy to figure out the code, but it wasn't easy to figure out the location at first. Because he didn't draw any topography or any markers like, you know, 40 paces from the old oak tree, you know, X marks the spot kind of thing. That would have been real nice, but he didn't do that. So it took a long time for me to figure out where they were actually located.
And how did you finally break the code as to the location of the treasure?
Well, at first I thought at most he would maybe have buried, or maybe, at most it'd be maybe a saddlebag full of gold and silver coins or a jar of silver coins. But over the years, while I was trying to determine the location, we were contacted. My mother used to talk a lot with the former Attorney General of the state of Texas, Wagner Carr. He's now passed away. Wagner Carr would talk with her. He sent his driver out to show my mother and I where several of the locations were of large catches that had been recovered. One was 12 miles from my home near Georgetown, Texas, and then there was others north of it. So I had two locations. I still couldn't figure out how this template is a treasure template that was alleged to be, it was alleged to be a KGC or Knights of the Golden Circle template. And at the time, I had no reason to doubt that. But I was trying to figure out how the template worked and how it lined up with all these treasure locations. I couldn't quite get it to work until an elderly gentleman by the name of George Roaming, he was a 32nd degree Freemason and a Shriner. He, real nice old guy, when he was 10 years old, he knew Jesse when Jesse was an old man. And Jesse had hired, and he swore George to an oath and hired him to help him move and bury 680 bars of gold. He drew a map for my mother and I where that was. So I had a third location, and that's when I got the big break on the scale and dimension of the template.
680 bars of gold, and how much did each bar weigh, do we know?
He said approximately 15 pounds.
Oh, Lord.
That's a lot of gold.
15 pounds, so that's 15 times 16 ounces, roughly $1,400 an ounce times 650 bars. Oh, my gosh, I can't do the math. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
A whole lot of money.
And that was only one of... let me just back up a minute. We're heading into a break, but I've got a couple of minutes here. I just want to explore this little side road here.
Okay.
This gentleman that was taking your mother out and showing her where they had recovered other caches of gold.
Yes.
How did they know about those, and how did they find those?
Those, well, one of them, they had known the area, and we didn't get a lot of details on that. That was kind of, he just wanted us to know where they were, and he didn't go into how they knew. But his driver had mentioned that one of the locations had been discovered by a man who was selling it in the black market, and she didn't like that. The driver believed that gold belonged to Texas, so she contacted the Texas Rangers, and everything was taken care of. And afterwards, in the long run, after all the research I've done, I agree with her. I believe it belongs to certain people, the Freemasons, the Knight Templar, and others who it belongs to. I'm glad now. At the time, I thought, dang, I would have loved to have had some, but after all the research I've done, I'm glad that happened.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about your great-great-granddad's connection with the Freemasons. You've sort of alluded to that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But the Knights Templar, my gosh, I mean, that's going back a spell. They were charged with the duty of guarding the pilgrims to the Holy Land. What could they possibly have to do with the outlaw Jesse James? We'll find out on the other side. Now, taking us into the break, here's Craig Cardiff. Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. An old Bob Dylan tune. Coming back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.